Welcome back to Radio Rothbard. Though Bishop here, joined, as always, by Ryan McMakin. And we realized that we really haven't done an episode based off of Ryan's latest book, Breaking Away, The Case for Secession, Radical Decentralization, and Small Polities. If you do not have your copy yet, you get a discount using the promo code Rothpod, R-O-T-H-P-O-D, at the Mises bookstore. That's at Mises.org/breakingaway. And Ryan, one of the reasons I love your book, not only because I'm paid to promote your book, but the different aspects of the question of secession, of decentralization, and something we're going to focus on today is a topic that has come up in the news cycle for really several years now. I really think that this gets, really puts the finger on the pulse of some of the more interesting, real political questions out there, as opposed to a lot of the political distractions that often fills that topic. And that really is the topic of nationalism. And, nationalism is a very interesting phenomenon. I know Hans Mönhappa has talked about how nationalism in the 19th century was a bad thing because that, kind of contributed to the centralization of power away from a more decentralized state. But in the modern context, it really, I think can be fairly seen as a step away from modern centralization of power on more of a global scale. And so this is why the topic does come up in your book. And I think you have a few chapters kind of similar on the topic, but one in particular, I love the title of it, is Nationalism as National Liberation. And in particular, I know we're going to talk about some of the lessons from a very specific instance again, American history, American serious foreign policy folks were really bad on at the time, is the lessons from the Cold War as a very interesting empirical example of secession working. And so, Ryan, that's a long lineup into to the larger question here of, what is the role of nationalism as a force when we consider the broader topic of, again, secession and political decentralization?
Yeah, nationalism can be either good or bad. That's the thing about it, is historically, when you look at the scholarship around the origins of the state and state building and state formation and all of that, is nationalism can play a role. It didn't necessarily play a role in the early, early days of state formation. So we're talking about the 16th and 17th century. Nationalism wasn't really a full-blown thing then. It was really just more based on allegiance to a particular dynasty and such. But it very much became a thing in the 18th and 19th century. And people started to think of themselves as members of this larger group based on some sort of cultural or linguistic affinity. And that doesn't come naturally. That hasn't always been the way people think, at least not beyond like the level of a city or a group of people that you see on a daily basis. And so certainly there was some element of nationalism, if you want to call it that, local patriotism in the city-states of Greece, for example, or in Florence in the early modern period. But these were very, very local ideas, and these were people you knew in most cases. Plus, these cities tended to be quite small by today's standards. We're talking tens of thousands of people in many cases. So it doesn't really apply at all. It's not what we mostly think of when we think of nationalism now, which is a state of maybe 10, 20, 50, 100 million people who all feel like they have something in common with each other based maybe on language or religion or culture, but it's usually much broader than that. And so it's a fairly new development, but it doesn't always help the state in the sense that if the nation, if your idea of the nation doesn't align with the idea of the state, that is, if your borders are not coterminous, so you have an idea about what your nation is, and you're composed of maybe certain communities within a larger state, then that sort of nationalism hurts state building and tends to break states up. If your idea of the nation is the same thing and lines up with some existing national state, then that's great for state building, because it creates this idea, this ideology in the minds of most of your citizens that they're French instead of being Catholic or instead of being from Lyon or Breton or something like that, some other regional identity. And so as long as most people think that their overriding idea is that, yeah, I'm a member of this national group, the status quo group, which has its own state, then that's very much going to help the state perpetuate itself. But states run into big trouble then when you have nationalist movements, nationalist groups that either overlap with some other state, like say think of Kurdistan and Kurdish nationalism. That's essentially a threat to Turkey, Iraq, and Iran, maybe even a little bit to Syria, because they don't have their own state. And then, of course, Catalonia, they don't have their own state. And so they have their own nationalist group, which is separate, of course, from Spanish nationalism, which very much exists, although that tends to be denied when people try to use nationalism as a pejorative term. And it's very often used that way. And probably the easiest way to see that is you'll often see the media use the term ultra-nationalist, which is usually a bad thing. You almost never see anyone mention ultra-internationalists, right, which would presumably be someone from like the World Economic Forum or one of these groups of the ultra-wealthy who seem to be associated with no particular nation. Right? That's never bad. They're never ultra something. They're never extremists. It's only nationalists who tend to be extremists. So we know that that tends to be seen as something bad, but it can be good in terms of breaking down and restraining state power. It just depends on the circumstances. It could go either way.
Of course, I know some credit the impact of Napoleonic France as kind of helping birth nationalism within Europe, because it created a counter to sort of the spread of French revolutionary ideas, right? Where you have the French Empire creating these puppet states and they were capturing sort of this very romantic idea of what revolutionary ideas were meant to mobilize. These people that had their own critiques of the standing order, and nationalism kind of created an identity against this growing imperial power. And so there, it is something perhaps a little bit more similar to kind of the current concerns about, a more globalist, a political order, identified by, various different political schemes ranging from, the Davos crowd and sort of multinational kind of corporate interest, right? With all sorts of very shadowy figures, and different plots by everything ranging from the Great Reset and kind of the technocratic authoritarian sort of order there, to other sort of agendas there. This is kind of fueling a resurrection in interest in sort of nationalistic as a political sort of focal point, creating tension to what is concerns about, so that consolidation of political power, rising from, whether it's Trumpism or whatever you want to call it, the United States, that America First sort of style of conservatism. Brexit was to a certain extent a political manifestation of that within the UK. Hasn't necessarily turned out that way over time, perhaps. I think some criticisms there. Then, of course, the general response to I think the increasingly heavy-handed policies of the European Union, leading to all sorts of very interesting disruptions and kind of the political norms there. What's interesting as well, there's a fascinating article by Joe Salerno on this, published several years ago, that Mises himself viewed nationalism kind of from his own lens. I think it's always interesting, Mises' own sort of notion of liberalism, I think, stands out from the pack with its foundation within property rights. And I think his concept of liberal nationalism also stands out compared to perhaps other definitions that other people might have. But Salerno highlights a passage from Mises that the nationality principle includes only the rejection of every lord or overlordship. It demands self-determination and autonomy. Then, however, it contends, its content expands. Not only freedom, but also unity is the watchword. The desire for national unity, too, is above all thoroughly peaceful. Nationalism does not clash with cosmopolitanism, for the unified nation does not want discord with neighboring peoples, but peace and friendship. So again, he very much recognizes that there's this dynamic there where national identity can help create a more stable global order. It does not have to be jingoistic and militaristic and imperialist in nature. And I think we're talking about the ways that political decentralization, the progress towards smaller political units, the way that the lessons that we can take away, as you mentioned several times, both in your book and your talks, if we think about anarchism from a very pragmatic political landscape, foreign affairs and international politics is an anarchistic state, and therefore we can learn lessons from that from the international arena that can apply to a more localized arena. And perhaps help us work through genuine concerns of statecraft and the goals of creating a peaceful, less arbitrarily enforced a political order.
Yeah, I think Richard Cobden, the great 19th century liberal, showed that it's perfectly possible to be liberal and generally nationalistic in the sense of Cobden certainly wasn't jingoistic, was anti-war, and was very pro-free trade. But he certainly considered himself to be an Englishman, and there was no confusion there about his origins or what country he considered to be his own. But he also didn't have anything against the French and wanted to trade with them and be at peace with them and get along with them perfectly fine. So, yeah, of course, Mises is correct. And even looking at, when you think of Mises, you think of Austria-Hungary, right? I think if the First World War had not happened, even that case of, oh, look at what nationalism did to Austria-Hungary, we wouldn't even be talking about that, because that nationalism was actually fairly well managed in the late 19th century in Austria-Hungary. The Hungarians wanted more autonomy, and so did some of the other ethnic groups. And all that ended up doing was simply making Austria-Hungary more tolerant and more decentralized as a regime, which was all to the good. And it certainly, and Mises writes about that in some of his early works as well, noting that some of the best parts of the way that Austria-Hungary was constructed was just on how it was so flexible in terms of working with all these different national groups within its borders, without demanding any sort of single language or assimilation to a particular ethnicity or anything like that. And that probably could have endured for quite some time if events had not interceded as it did in Austria. And maybe it was indeed, it's unclear if it was nationalism that impelled the Austrians to engage in that dumb folly of requiring the Serbians to basically just give up all autonomy and start taking orders from Vienna. And so that was a miscalculation there. But it wasn't necessarily something that would have been demanded under a regime that had lots of different competing national groups. So it would be possible for these groups to get along with each other. That's just not the way it worked out because of the way that the fortunes of war went afterward. But yeah, there's you can't look at nationalism and say that it's automatically bad. It just can be and has coincided with the rise of the state in many ways. And so clearly it's not a antidote to states necessarily as well. It just can be. But as you note also in that, in the case of international groups, right? Of course, it serves a good function in preventing the centralization of power under the European Union, where considerable amount of nationalism endures among the member states who don't want to actually be hammered into one single unitary state of any kind. And this is a point Carlo Lottieri, who wrote the foreword to my book, has often made. And he's a secessionist in Italy. He's part of these groups that recognize that Northern Italy basically subsidizes Southern Italy, and they have to endure undue repression, if you will, from Rome.
And certainly Rome gets real nasty whenever they talk about getting any additional autonomy for regions in Italy. But nonetheless, Carlo also recognizes that nationalism can prevent, even where it does solidify power within the Italian state, can prevent a Europe-wide power from taking shape. And so that's good, too. The question is just to turn that sort of localism into even more micro-localism to then ensure that local regions have autonomy, just as they would expect, just as the Italians want autonomy from a larger Europe.
And that played into the disintegration of the Soviet Union. You know, perhaps one of the, you know, I know Murray Rothbard, you know, talked about it being one of the most important political developments, you know, for the libertarian cause, if you will, the collapse of such a large totalitarian state. And can you talk a little bit about, you know, again, this is, I know for Rothbard with his article on Nations by Consent, the disintegration and the role that ethnic identities, you know, kind of creating that sort of decentralizing nationalistic spirit, kind of helped shape his views on certain political things. Actually, could be argued in perhaps a more Misesian direction, if you will. Can you talk a little bit about that? And as well as, again, the really fascinating counter history there, how you know the West was very much concerned, very, very, very skeptical of that disintegration of power on these ties, and would much rather have seen kind of maintaining that sort of a status quo centralized state, perhaps wielded for different ideological ends.
Yeah, it's very fun, really, to look back and look at the old press clippings from the early 1990s. What was going on in terms of the American press? What were the opinions about the breakup of the Soviet Union at the time? And it was indeed ethnic nationalism that contributed a whole lot to the breakup of the Soviet Union, especially in the Baltics, but also in Ukraine, and less so, obviously, in Belarus, which never actually broke off. But even Kazakhstan started talking about Kazakhstan nationalism, right? And you had this as well in Armenia and in the Caucasus. And so what was the thinking there? The idea is that, well, we historically were our own people, and this is typical nationalist narrative, right? Sometimes it's invented or exaggerated beyond the reality. Like to this day, Ukrainians will act like they have this many centuries old national tradition when there's actually very little evidence for that. But it is quite clear, however, that by the late 20th century, there was some feelings of having a separate language, a separate culture to some extent, even though there was a huge amount of overlap between Russian and Ukrainian interests in the old Soviet Union. It was clear by 1992 that there was a feeling of separateness and that they wanted their own national language, national literature, national identity that was separate from the Russians. And so then you start telling a lot of stories about all of the evils you've endured at the hands of this neighboring ethnicity, and that really just starts to fuel it even more. So what you had happen over that time period in the early 90s was you had referenda in Ukraine, in the Baltics, where the Baltics were the most bold about it, because, of course, they had been independent earlier in the 20th century and still imagined themselves as independent entities in many cases. So there was much more a feeling of separateness and ill will toward the Russians and the Baltics. And they were among the first just to peel off from the Soviet Union and say, all right, Moscow, if you want us to stay in this country, it's your move. You better do something about it. And the Soviets were in too bad of shape economically, and just their state suffered from such a legitimacy deficit at that point that there was very little that they could do. So the Baltic states were fairly easily able to pull away. Of course, then they immediately start encountering issues of what are our national languages? There's a sizable Russian ethnic minority here. What do we do about that? And that addresses a lot of the questions that people start asking, right? If you started breaking up the United States, where would the people live? What about people who wanted to live in another state and so on? Well, that always is something you have to deal with when you have states peel off, and that's exactly what happened in the Baltics. But of course, it was a generally peaceful process with very little bloodshed, even though these were small countries next to much, much larger countries. And there was certainly no promise of defense from NATO at the time that that was going on. And that happened. But what was interesting was that a lot of people in the West were warning that this was a bad thing. They were warning that all these flare-ups of nationalism are going to lead to widespread disorder, and we need to support really just a transfer of the Soviet Union from an old Soviet state into a modern democracy. So they imagined sort of this federal state where the Latvians and the Lithuanians and the Estonians would be forced to stay within the country and vote. And through somehow these 3 million, well, far less than that, really, when you think of the voting population, I'd say maybe the voting population was 1.5 million or something in the Baltics, that somehow was going to give them self-determination within a huge Russian federation. But that was what the New York Times, that was what the Bush administration wanted. And it was the same thing with Ukraine, was there was generally opposition in Washington and among media elites to the idea of Ukraine seceding. This was nationalism run amok. We can't just let people do this. And it's just crazy to let countries break up into smaller pieces. But in the end, the Ukrainians voted something like 93% for independence. And Washington had to live with that. But that was all based on this idea of national separateness. It was clearly nationalism was a major issue at work there. And that illustrates how since the borders of the imagined nation of those different Baltic countries and the Ukraine, it didn't match up, of course, with the borders of the Soviet Union, then that created a drive to break up an existing state into smaller pieces. So that worked in secession's favor in that case and certainly brought about a different status quo. And to this day, really, the parts of Ukraine that are not heavily Russian, the Russians stand no chance of any sort of really effective occupation of those places because of Ukrainian nationalism. That still endures. It's only in those places in the east where they can claim a significant minority or even majority of Russian ethnics that they can hope to maybe hold on to those regions for any significant amount of time. That's why the Russians are restrained to places like South Ossetia instead of Georgia overall, because Georgian nationalism continues to be an issue, and it's really hard then to get those people to submit to control. And you just look at how hard the Chechens fought in the Chechen War in the Soviet Union for independence there, and ultimately failed because the Chechen Republic was basically completely surrounded by the Russian state at that point, and they hadn't managed to win over much Western support either. But we can see very clearly in these cases that nationalism was a motivating factor. And in his writings, Rothbard talks a lot about those sorts of conflicts, all referring mostly to things that came before the breakup of the Soviet Union, but labeling it cases of national liberation, such as, I mean, he looked at Vietnam as basically a case of national liberation from French Indochina, and later from the meddling Americans who decided to get involved. And he even labeled then the American Revolution. He may have labeled it the first case of national liberation, although Ralph Rako would say that really the first case of national liberation was the Dutch Republic breaking away from the Habsburgs' lands after the 80 Years' War. But however you want to come down on that, the fact of the matter is that, yes, this is something that very much predates the modern era. We're going back to the 18th or maybe even the 17th century, but it does tend to be motivated, at least toward the later years of the conflict, by feelings of national separateness and national identity that grow out of whatever other conflicts might arise.
And, of course, one of the ways that Russia, the Soviet Union, dealt with trying to undermined these nationalistic tensions that threatened the stability and the power of the regime. Was using ethnic mobility. It was at certain points. I mean, for example, we could talk about in the modern context, right? One of the particular flashpoints with the Russian-Ukraine situation is Crimea, because of the degree to which Crimea has historical ties and how Russian ethnically the population is, and how Crimea It was kind of vulgar politics that led to Crimea staying Ukrainian and the way that's played out with referendums and things like that. But of course, if you go far enough back in Crimean history, Crimea was occupied by the Tartars, who were, I believe, a Turkish. So something very ethnically different than the Russians that are there now. They had to move away an ethnic group to Russianize Crimea. They had to mingle in Russian settlers into different parts, and this dynamic of the degree to which the really authoritarian regimes can weaponize, can deal with sort of the ethnic breaking down of tradition. The Soviet Union is really a very horrifying example of that in practice, and I think that fuels a lot of the concerns. Both in the European level, if you think about, while the Soviet Union was in decline, you have the empowerment of the EU, who was designed as a political project to try to remake Europe to with perhaps the noble goal, if you will, of removing the tensions that had led to two world wars in the 20th century. But there are concerns about the removal of those sort of longstanding traditions and nationalities and all of these different hierarchical pre-state pre-political connections and loyalties. And then the Soviet Union very much does demonstrate a very real example of the degree to which a truly authoritarian regime, the extents that they will go to, and obviously religion plays a role in that as well, the extents the way they will go to eliminate all of those connections that create any sort of check against the very horrific state power.
Well, that's the dark side of nationalism, is that the dominant state does a lot to stamp out, often through very violent means, local feelings of local patriotism. And you can, of course, find many examples in Russian history, right? It's not even just the Soviet Union. It's under the Russian Empire as well. Efforts to take these small ethnicities, especially in the Caucasus, and just put people... on the road, put them in trains or send them on some death march somewhere and move them to some other part of the country where there is no sense of national unity and an idea of here we can stage some sort of local revolt where we will unite together and with our ethnic brethren. So one strategy to do that is you take the Georgians or the Armenians or the Azerbaijanis, and you just take 500,000 of them and you move them somewhere else. Look at ancient Israel, right? The exile, the idea was to just crush the idea of a unified local culture that was contrary to the ruling regime. And it occurs in less... sketchy regimes than Tsarist or Soviet Russia, where there was more lip service even played to liberty, which was the case, say, under the French. The French spent a lot of time in the 19th century after Napoleon trying to stamp out local languages, local allegiances, and that was done largely through public schooling, where you were only allowed to learn French, Parisian-style French. None of the hated patois languages, which only hillbillies and hicks were apparently supposed to speak, at least as defined by people in Paris. And so no more of that backwardness. We're going to teach you a civilized language. That's all you'll get in these government-funded schools. We'll even try and prohibit the use of signs and like road signs in your local language and try and prevent any sort of local movements promoting local nationalism. And so oftentimes the police were used to stamp these things out. And lots of unsavory methods were used. And of course, the United States used methods like that with the indigenous population, and in World War I with all of the anti-German sentiment, the internment of the Japanese, the more limited internment even of the Italians during the Second World War, which people rarely ever talk about anymore, but which was a thing. And so all those sorts of things have been employed, less so in the United States just because of constitutional problems and perhaps just the vastness of the country and the difficulty of getting unified national policy there, because you might have a local ethnic group that could use the Senate to veto some particularly bad policy against your ethnic group. And I was just reading, for example, about how George Washington's moves against ethnic German dissenters against the taxes in after the Revolution. He was considered very anti-German after that, and the Federalists were never able to win the ethnic Germans back in the 19th century after that. And well, the Whigs, they turned into the Whigs. So that became a real problem. But in the United States, you're much more easily able to exercise at least some power as an ethnic group just because of the non-democratic way that the Senate functions, that it gives these minority groups a little more power than they would have had otherwise. But in a unitary state like France, you're just at the mercy of the majority. So it just ends up, the more time goes on, the easier it is to stamp out local ethnicities, local languages and such. So certainly not something that's reserved to authoritarian dictatorial regimes. It's just something that's been used for a long time in Western Europe as well. Spain, especially as well, like in Spain proper, the triumph of the monarch over the local legislatures that occurred in the 17th and 18th century. So it's been a long process of hammering into shape these currently existing nation states, but they used to contain many more nationalities and many more ideas of nationalism used to prevail in these places, but they were stamped out over time. But some have endured and some are coming back, and so it will be interesting to see how that develops over time.
Hey guys, this is Tho Bishop with Radio Rothbard. I've got a special deal for you for this holiday season. Using the promo code Murray Christmas, that's M-U-R-R-A-Y Christmas, you can get 10% off of some of our great new apparel. We've got some great, a new Mises hoodie with a Tu Ne Se Malice on one of the sleeves. Looks great. A classic Rothbardian black and yellow. We also have some new Under Armour polo shirts in a variety of colors, including auburn, blue, and orange for those looking for a game day fit there. And then we also have some great Rothbard hats that code works for. So again, the promo code Murray Christmas. That will give you 10% off these great apparel items. Now, let's get back to the show.
I want to touch on a little bit kind of the differences with this resurrected nationalistic fervor and any of the National Conservative Project and a few other sort of different sort of ideologies out there trying to tap into that and some of the interesting dynamics comparing it to the United States. But going back to some stuff you're saying right there, I mean, one interesting example, I think, is kind of the Reconstruction area after the Civil War, where you had the political disenfranchisement of a large percentage of American Southerners. You had the movement of Yankee politicians, for lack of a better word, coming in, kind of using political dominance there. But you've also had, and I think this continues to a certain extent to this day, and this ties into public education and historical curriculums, that the narrative that the state, particularly with a very federally influenced educational apparatus, that the narrative of American history or history generally is another tool by which you can erode away some of these ethnic, localized historical differences, that the narratives there matter. And I think if we think about the transition from the 20th century to the 21st century, I hate, I'm cringing at what I'm about to do, Jonah Goldberg has his book on liberal fascism that has kind of the smiley face as the sort of thing there. I think that there is perhaps something to the dynamic that if we want to simplify things, overly simplify things, 20th century authoritarianism
you know, was very, you know, you think of the Nazi aesthetics, right? You know, it looks spooky. It looks, you know, sort of a dystopian sort of thing. You know, it's visually, you can point to that. It's like, oh yeah, that's a little scary right there. In the 21st century, the authoritarianism of today, particularly in the West, kind of comes with a kindler, gentler image. You know, it has that sort of smiley face motif. And so perhaps, you know, I think that there's a larger dynamic to which the degree to that any, you know, for one, getting any younger generations, I think particularly right now, and, you know, we can, you know, blame all of the, you know, sort of, you know, modern tropes that we want to do, ranging from TikTok to, you know, whatever, getting people at all to consume any sort of level of history is a difficulty when you consider that the majority of history either comes from federal influence at the very least historical curriculum, you know, from a school apparatus, or this sort of nationalized, homogenistic narrative that there very much is, you know, that is one of the ways that they're able to shape future generations, where you don't have to use that set of heavy handed, you know, we're putting, you know, Southerners in a train and relocating them to a different thing. It doesn't matter if the next generations are taught that your ancestors were the boogeymen of American history and you should hate them, right? That, you know, that they're, you know, and all, you know, this isn't some sort of, you know, sinister plot. This is just the facts, man. This is how history went. And, you know, don't like your grandfather, right? You know, that dynamic and the way in which the regime is effective in ways that can be so easy to overlook, I think is you know, kind of within the background of some of what is animating, you know, a lot of the concerns. It's animating some of the culture war aspect. It's animating some of this extreme polarization within the political process as people kind of recognize and wake up to concerns about the way that younger generations are being shaped by a cultural, national, and I just think, you know, a homogenous narrative in a variety of fronts, and you know, eroding against some of those pre-political bonds that, you know, can create barriers to, you know, a total state of you know, whatever ideology is baked into that apparatus.
Well, Americans have just been very effective at that in general, right? In the 19th century, history books were, right, there was no dissenting narrative whatsoever. It was the idea of, well, the United States was founded and it's been moving west, and history and God and the tides of humanity have been all of on our side. We've never lost a war. And everyone will be assimilated to the greatness that is America. And this was not just something you were taught in schools. It's extremely animating ideology. It's what drove a lot of people who settled in the West, where you get in a wagon train and you go over 1,000 miles of hostile territory to the Oregon coast. And then you just sit there confident that this place out in the middle of nowhere will eventually be integrated into America. And that because it can't be stopped, of course, everywhere in North America will become America. And that was just the level of confidence that people had that this sort of progress would occur everywhere was really quite astounding. And it was extremely effective. And you can just see the fruit of it in the fact that the United States has always been very effective. The United States government has been very effective at getting majority support for its efforts to quash the minority groups, whether it's ideological, whether it's people who would say just oppose the war, right? There weren't a whole lot of Americans all worked up about the sedition laws that came out of World War I. They just figured, hey, they opposed this glorious war to end all wars in Europe. And so if President Woodrow has to imprison some of these people, then so be it. And you can look and you see how there were never national laws really requiring people to stand up and during the national anthem or put your hand over your heart or recite the Pledge of Allegiance. These were all grassroots things that just came up from the bottom because people loved it, because people believed so much in this idea of the national project. And so extremely effective nationalism at work there in the way the history books were written. And that's a point Benedict Anderson makes in his book on nationalism, is that if you want good national unity, make sure you've got good literature, good schools, and good museums. That this will, right? So every museum I go to tells me the same narrative, the story of how America came to be and who the good guys are and who the bad guys are. And of course, every classroom is a miniature museum. You just walk into a classroom and you see who's on the wall, what pictures of people. Probably a picture of Lincoln, picture of Martin Luther King, maybe Gandhi. You know who the good guys are. You know who the bad guys are. And so you get taught that, and then you believe it, and your ideas of nationhood proceed from there. But I do think that then what comes next, I think if the United States splits up, even in a de facto way before any sort of de jure split comes up, how is that going to manifest itself? And that's probably one of the questions I get most often is when people read the book or they see a podcast about the book is, well, how does that happen? What are the splits going to be? And I think that brings us to the issue of you do need some sort of catalyst that would bring around a real split. And how would you do that? And one way is... just some very instrumental stuff. You need to break up the welfare state, right? You need to get people so that they don't see their economic welfare tied to getting a check from the federal government. But another big factor there really is creating some sort of idea of nationhood or group that's separate from the United States overall. Because we look at the Soviet example, we look at the resistance to centralization that you have in Europe now and in the past. There was always some sort of local allegiance that had to be there. Now, so it's all to the good if there really is some sort of Florida nationalism, right? That's taking shape. But if that does really develop, they're going to be way ahead of most other states, right? Because there isn't much in the way of Iowa nationalism or Wisconsin nationalism. So the question is, where do you get these ideas of separateness, right? Everybody speaks English in spite of the idea that all these immigrants are coming here not speaking English. The fact is that their kids go to public school and then they learn English. So speaking English it's pretty well imprinted on everybody and will continue to be so just because there's so many benefits to speaking English other than just fitting in the United States. It just makes you better off globally. And so it's probably not going to be any sort of linguistic difference, and the numbers of people who insist on not speaking English are far too small to bring about some sort of effective secession movement there, right? You've got to have some sort of ideological separateness, and that's where you start to see these real ideas of, I'm not like those people. And a joke that I bring up is something that was a repeated plot point in that old sitcom 30 Rock, where you'll remember the conservative guy Jack Donaghy was out with Liz Lemon, the left-wing producer of the show, right? And they were searching the nation for a new comedic talent, and they had to go to Georgia, and Jack kept referring how we're going to find our next big comedian in real America. We're going to go down to rural Georgia. That's where real America is. And Liz kept annoyingly trying to correct him, saying, well, all of America is real America, Jack. So implying that even New Yorkers are real Americans too. But I think there is really an ongoing feeling on both sides that there is. My guys are real America, and your people are traitors or extremists or something like that. And there seems to be this sort of feeling on both sides in many cases. It manifests itself very differently, but there's certainly a feeling among people who are then they're religious conservatives out in the suburbs, and they see leftists in the central city as some sort of different sort of place, right? That's not my America, that's your America. And then you can see it in the writings of the left when they describe these right-wing conservative types is they're fascists, they're anti-American. Anti-American, that's a very commonly used term on both sides, but certainly used on the left. They are opponents of what we think of as America. They're traitors, especially if someone mentions how they like Robert E. Lee or something. Then we'll spend 10 minutes talking about how Robert E. Lee was a traitor. There's plenty of reasons to not like Robert E. Lee, but treason is isn't a good one. And so you can see, I think, this real split up ideologically. The problem is that it's hard to untangle that from geographic realities because these people tend to live closely together. However, I think we're going to start to see, we've already been seeing that for more than 20 years, as people relocating, not just across state lines, but just to different neighborhoods, different cities, different counties. And that was all, I think, accelerated by COVID also. I'm going to go live among my people, my America, and that's different from those people somewhere else.
Well, and I think one of the reasons why kind of the secessionist spirit perhaps has always been a little bit brighter in Texas rather than others is, you know, I think it's little things, but like I know Texas history classes are like a big part of kind of their baked in state curriculum. You know, growing up in Florida, I never had a Florida history class, right? Yeah, you see a lot more Texas flags driving through Texas than you see Florida flags driving through Florida. And this is changing a little bit. Changing a little bit of sorts, but I actually have a buddy of mine who he starts his clubs now, started doing a pledge to the state of Florida as a kind of interesting parallel to the pledge to the United States, which is also done, but it's kind of just kind of making people think within that sort of identity aspect of the state. And what I think is interesting, and perhaps, you know, lamentably so, is that politics really has been, I think, perhaps the only outlet where you can kind of really express these sort of cultural differences. And perhaps throughout history, right, you know, the only divide on that, the sort of secular saints of civic nationalism that you were kind of referring to earlier, the certain figures, you know, there have kind of been at times, you know, partisan icons, right? You know, it was Andrew Jackson and, you know, FDR and, you know, I think Jefferson was usually thrown in there as sort of the Democrat party. I mean, ironic now with most of those people, but, you know, that's the Democrat saints. The Republican Party, you had Lincoln and you had Eisenhower, right, and you had Reagan. And it really, I mean, party politics has only kind of been the acceptable sort of avenue for this for a while. And it's going to be interesting to see with, you know, whether or not, particularly with some of the changes now, I think this is ties into what has made DeSantis so successful here in Florida. I have to get my pitch in there. Is that, you know, the aggressive use of school curriculums and sort of the culture war battles, where if you're in a red state and it feels different, if it feels raising a family is fundamentally different in a red state than a blue state, as we see these sort of cultural dynamics amplify in ways that I still find, even myself as someone who is consumes way too much political content than a healthy man should. Even I'm overwhelmed at times with how quickly this stuff can accelerate. You know, perhaps recognizing that these larger sort of meta aspects of politics, beyond just casting votes and sort of playing public policy, that is really what sets the stage for a more fundamental reevaluation of kind of this American centralized project that we've kind of taken for granted for well over 100 years now.
Well, and a lot of those things seem cheesy to people, like we're going to do a Pledge of Allegiance to Florida, that sort of thing. But the fact of the matter is that was the bread and butter of what forged all of these ideas of untrammeled allegiance to the U.S. government and to the idea of America. It was all the iconography. It was the little quasi-prayers, the hymns. The pseudo-religious stuff that makes a tear form in your eye when you hear some patriotic song. Obviously, that doesn't happen to me, but it happens to a lot of people because they've been trained to feel that way. And you look at how people get so angry if someone else doesn't stand up during the national anthem or something like that, right? I mean, these people are so invested in this stuff that they lose their ability to manage their own emotions, right? So you have grown men throwing temper tantrums over someone else's display of patriotism, and it's quite remarkable. And of course, they always say, "Well, my second half cousin was a Marine, and so I have a right to punch you in the face for not saying the Pledge of Allegiance." Or whatever, like what? But I mean, people have been totally brainwashed on this stuff. So what you really do need is you need to counter brainwashing. Right? I mean, that's really the only way to do it, is you have to convince people that they have allegiance to something else. Now, preferably, it would be to like a extended family group, to their religious group, to something that humanity is more hardwired to be into in terms of granting their allegiance. And historically, you were attached to some particular dynastic group, which was usually very local, some ruling family within your community that you had some sort of economic and familial attachment to. Think of the factions in, say, the city-states of Italy and so on. It wasn't primarily ideological necessarily. But if that's the only thing that can really divide Americans, then that's what it's probably going to be, is you're just going to have these ideological ideas, probably infused with also some religious ideas and a different version of history. But you're going to have to create and ensure that people learn that different version of history, and that people are adopting different symbols. And something that would be fun, right, is to just get people to, when they fly both the state and the federal flag, to reverse it and fly the federal flag under the state flag on the flagpole. That would be funny. And to see how people reacted to that, too. because people still, on like Twitter and stuff, people get really worked up about that. Like, I saw a picture of IKEA, and IKEA flew... they fly a IKEA like corporate flag, a Swedish flag, and a U.S. flag on their poles outside, and somebody got really upset about it. How supposedly you're supposed to fly the U.S. flag higher, but then somebody's like quoting the U.S. code about how no, the proper way to display the flags is this. So apparently, people are still really, really into this stuff, and so of course at our Rothbardian groups, we all sort of mock that sort of thing, but obviously it commands a lot of attention from certain people. So you've got to provide something, some sort of substitution. I don't think, of course, that just die-hard individualism. I don't need anybody. I've been divorced 3 times, and all I need is my dog and my 50 guns, and I'm perfectly happy. Those people need to see a psychiatrist. I mean, the normal people, they're like into socializing with groups. They have identities that extend beyond themselves. And so we need to really encourage people then to really invest themselves in this and stop getting worked up about the U.S. national government. And I think maybe you are starting to see signs of that. A point that Jeff Deist has made, and I think is absolutely right, is that 21 years ago, when Al-Qaeda flew planes into the World Trade Center and all those New Yorkers were killed, the response from most Americans, virtually all Americans really, was they were aghast, horrified, viewed it as an attack on themselves, and immediately felt the need to pull together, send their hopes and prayers to New York, send money to New York to help the recovery, whatever, right? Would you get that sort of a feeling of affinity toward New York today if that sort of thing would happen? I think probably not, actually.
Well, and I think you saw that play out quite well with COVID, right? I mean, and COVID was one that was very interesting. I guess it was like the perfect tragedy for the moment, because for one, you had the very different responses from, you know, blue state America and red state America, to oversimplify things. And then that led to, you know, New Yorkers wishing death on Florida and vice versa. I'm not going to say that, you know, Florida was more righteous necessarily, right? But there kind of was, you know, this sort of dark, you know, my people killed, I hope your people die at greater numbers than my people do, because it justifies, you know, my, you know, whatever side, whatever rituals kind of were baked in there. And I'm not trying to both sides that either. I do think blue state's response was worse, but, you know, it kind of reflects my own values there. But COVID, I think, is a perfect example of how a national tragedy can further polarize a nation rather than bring it together. So perhaps that means that if Elon Musk really wants to continue being a threat to the standing order, maybe we need a state flag specific emojis to really get into the next generation digital war, so you don't have to have an American flag by your profile, but rather a Florida flag or a Texas flag. And those little things might fuel the little nationalistic tensions that we need to kind of exacerbate and further amplify these decentralizing aspects that are captivating modern political politics. And so, Ryan, I know we're wrapping up here. So again, this is just one of many aspects that Ryan touches on in his book, Breaking Away, The Case for Secession, Radical Decentralization, and Small Polities. If you've been listening to Radio Rothbard the last few weeks, you're probably tired of hearing me talk about the book. I'm going to continue to talk about the book because it is an important read. You can get your copy. I believe it's $12 at the Mises store. You get a discount on top of that with promo code ROTHPOD. That is Rothpod. And so please get your copy, buy some for your friends and family for Christmas. Be that guy during the holiday celebrations. For Ryan McMakin, this is Tho Bishop. Thank you for joining, and we will see you next time.